This is Jarrett Stebbin from the Daily Signal. I'm reporting from the National Conservatism Conference in Miami, Florida. And I am joined, I'm happy to be joined by Smatra Mitra, who is a fellow for national security at the Center for National Interest. Thank you so much for joining us here.
Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, you're quite welcome. And I think the first thing I really wanted to talk about is you wrote a great piece in the National Interest about the passing of Queen Elizabeth II, which I think, which I read, I thought was excellent. You brought up some great points about the passing of a romantic era in monarchy. And I realized that for our mostly American audience, of course, we always have a mixed feeling about the monarchy in general, as small R Republicans. But I think a lot of Americans saw the outpouring, of course, of affection for Queen Elizabeth II and saw really the passing of maybe a generation of people before. Can you talk to us about that piece and what this means for Great Britain?
First of all, thank you very much. I mean, that's very kind. The American conservative movement started. There is always an inherent contradiction and tension between the two different visions of conservatism. One, an agrarian society with a patrician class and senatorial class on top, which is the American model, or the Republican Rome model, whichever way you want to talk about. And the other is the obviously throne and altar monarchy. It might be different superficially, but there are also, you know, inherent themes in both of those visions, like both of them like tradition, both of them, you know, despise modernity that way. So I think when the American conservatives see the monarchy in UK, they might, you know, obviously the historical disagreements might be there, but they still see that there is this tradition which is being carried on. And I think that appeals to a lot of Americans as well. Like I, obviously, I live in America. So, you know, it's kind of like a mixed feeling for me too. But I totally understand, you know, why it's appealing to Americans. Like, I mean, I read somewhere that, you know, Royal News is read more in U.S. than in the U.K. Now, that partly because U.S. is massive, but also, I mean, there is something in it.
It makes sense. It's I think it's notable for Americans to see. Really, a stateswoman of grace and dignity in a time, especially when you consider modernity, that this is, to Americans, we see almost the Queen as almost like a national celebrity, but one who brings that kind of honor and dignity and grace to the position. And I think, especially as a conservative, there is something admirable and remarkable about simply upholding this tradition, the liberties that the British people have, while preserving the monarchy. When we see so many other countries, of course, the French Revolution being the most dramatic example of lopping off the king's head in a bloodbath that followed. There were a lot of other people that died and tyranny came in its wake, that the British have been able to kind of meld the system. And further that, in the modern world, I think which makes it stark. I mean, when you think of, you know, the greatness of the British Empire, you think of the monarchy, you think of all these things, that has survived modernity. And I think a lot of people feel that Queen Elizabeth brought it into that. Of course, I suppose the questions next is, what's going to happen when she's not there? What is the future for British monarchy when they don't have somebody like that who can carry on the tradition in the same way?
I think the two things on that. I mean, you're absolutely right about the Queen coming from a generation which essentially ties to a past we can't even imagine. Like, if you think of it through, like, you know, the first Prime Minister the Queen, you know, saw was Winston Churchill, who was born in the Victorian times at the peak of the British Empire. Like, just the span of, you know, 1874 to 2022 is more than 100 years, right? So that's one thing. One of the things what, you know, the Americans see, like the Queen herself, and that's part of the royalty business in UK. Like, if you are a royal, you have to serve in the armed forces. A lot of, you know, elite, you know, in other societies, you know, they are elites when they dictate the polity of a country, but they don't really actively take part. But the royals have to serve. The Queen served in the Second World War. All our sons, you know, our current king, essentially, he served as well in the Navy. William and Harry, you know, they served. So I think those are also some of the things that they think about. As for the future of the monarchy, it's something to do with the Anglican temperament of, you know, Bilbo Baggins and all that stuff. You know, people don't really like warfare and revolutions. I mean, they had, you know, when, you know, we always hear from, you know, other countries around England that, you know, England would be good with the Republic. But the last time England was a Republic, it really went bad for Ireland and France. So we don't want that to happen again. But overall, I think monarchy is going to face a little bit of, like, at the end of the day, it's a romantic aesthetic, right? I mean, you have feudal, you know, sentiments, you know, the liege lord, the king, you know, leading the country to war, that kind of stuff. Different generations, people don't really feel, you know, that kind of grand ideas anymore. You know, the mystic cords are kind of broken. Obviously, Britain is not the British Empire. There are no imperials who are in South Africa or India or Australia. I think some of the Commonwealth dominions might be one to be a republic. As for the monarchy, I think it's probably still going to stay in England, at least, or even in the United Kingdom. But it's going to be diminished like the European royalties. I mean, they are obviously, I mean, Kingdom of Sweden. Like, we don't really talk about Sweden being a kingdom, but it is a kingdom at the end of the day. So I think that would be a little bit of diminished roles, but I don't think it's going anywhere. I think the British people like monarchy anyway.
That makes sense. I think it's interesting how this much this ties into a topic I think that we've both touched in our writings, which is kind of, especially in the West, there's a kind of war on history and tradition. And
oh,
we've seen
I'm
it
a
being,
huge fan of your book.
Yeah, well, yeah. Thank you very much. I wrote the War on History, which is roiling not just the United States, but throughout the West. I mean, you could even say maybe the United States has given the world some of this disease, parts of the West, but this does seem to be a problem everywhere, where we see an active overturning of our traditions, where we came from, where a lot of young Americans, a lot of young people either don't know their traditions whatsoever, they're completely detached, or are actively hostile. Do you see that being as deep of a problem in the UK and throughout Europe as it is here in the United States? Where do you see that taking? Where's that next step going?
I think there are two points to that statement. One, which obviously you know more than me, higher education, one of the curses of higher education being mass-produced and mass, you know, elite, overproduction of elite is, you know, the quality goes down, right? I mean, I am an associate fellow of the Royal Historical Society, and just in my own field, the Department of History, for example, in different countries, like they... If someone is working on flit tactic during the First World War, he's also a First World War historian. If someone is working on rhetoric of letters from the trench, he's also a First World War historian. At the end of the day, when they're going to a university, they are fighting for the same job, right? I mean, they are, and given how scholarships and funding works, probably the second guy is getting the job, right? So, so the quality of history, the quality, the rigor of academia, the kind of research that comes out of historical departments goes down on one hand. Second, because those things are going down, because these are the people who are then going and, you know, producing the narrative, producing the thought content, you know, shaping the future generations, so to speak, that's just bad history. I mean, the 1619 project happening in the US, written by someone who's not even a historian, and that there are genuine historians who are opposed to it, they're not getting TV talk times. You know, and these are the projects that's getting, you know, funded and tenure in universities. And this is how narrative is shaped. And that obviously breaks the love for the future generations to come and feel anything, you know, traditional or anything, you know, that's connected to their own past. History as a subject is probably going to continue outside academia as far as I can see. I mean, I think at this point of time, there needs to be a counter movement of genuine history, which is happening outside how, where, you know, there's this gatekeeping going on, but there are pretty dark times ahead.
It is amazing to me to think about, especially when, you know, people, especially when they talk about offensive history or statues, and they say, well, put it in a museum, and I have to say, well, what are the museums going to teach? And I think that's where a lot of people think, well, what are we going to do? But at the same time, the amount of information out there is more than at any point in history. It's available. You can go to a bookstore. You can go on a website and find this information. You can become self-educated in a way that was absolutely impossible. I mean, that's the positive side of modernity, is there is a lot of, I think, yearning for these things, especially as the institutions and elite have become completely corrupted. From the outside, to educate yourself, to understand, hey, this is where we came from. These people are wrong. A lot of the official position seems to be, I mean, you even see a lot of historians, I think to a certain extent, have even tarnished their names because they're willing to jump aboard things like the 1619 Project because they think they will get media attention. They think they will get accolades. They've really watered down the reputation of their profession. And now people are looking elsewhere. And it feels like we're at a time where that information is out there if you're willing to seek that. And maybe that's the next step into creating some kind of revival of the traditions.
One of the things which is interesting for a historian to think of through is when you figure out the broad themes of how narrative is shaped in a country, there is this force towards egalitarianism, of course. Now, egalitarianism doesn't mean that everyone gets equally educated or equally, you know, wise. The wisdom doesn't translate in equality. What happens is people form their silos. So what's happening with extreme spread of knowledge, and, you know, initially, if you see any high civilization in human history, whether it's the Mughals or the Romans or Greek or, you know, British Empire or America, you know, in the waspy, you know, Protestant ways in the 1890s, there was this superstructure. The superstructure had the intelligence, had the wisdom to understand the history, to translate that. And it was also, I mean, the history has forever been a fight between the type of history that Herodotus would have written, like, which is more narrative and shaping a story, or Thucydides, which is more neutral. Now, yes, there has been this huge idea of neutrality and detached aspiration towards detached history, but that obviously is going down now. We're kind of going back to an old-school narrative-shifting kind of history. But the problem is, obviously, everyone is biased. You know, humans have their own biases. But if you even don't aspire to have a kind of detached neutrality, you are not writing a story that will not be thrown down tomorrow. There is no reality. It's a war on reality itself. Like, if you do not even think that there needs to be at least some kind of checks and balances to figure out that the claims that you're making have any empirical basis, you know, there is no story. And the moment a nation has no story to tell, if it's the moment the nation has no positive story to tell, their ties, you know, it gets, you know, fractured. So I think that's a huge threat, essentially, to, you know, the 1776 department, I think, well, in Hillsdale, they are doing really good stuff about promoting an alternate version of history. I think that's the only way to do, like, provide that, hey, everything is not just bad, you know, there are other ways. And we actually have a really good history. I mean, people were not, they were not perfect in history, but they gave the ideas that forms the basis of a future improvement, and that's a great thing.
Yeah, I think it's one thing I always note, you know, when you point out the flaws in the history of the West and the United States, a lot of these people haven't studied the rest of human history, they haven't studied the rest of the world, and I think there's a lot of shocking things that, again, that's part of the lack of knowledge, I think, from society, that now all the criticism, that's all we get now. I mean, in the West, we're very self-critical, but now that's all you're getting.
Yeah.
And when you get that to a general audience, and they think, well, why do we have all these things? Are these things all bad? Are they corrupt? And we do have a lot of great things, obviously. There's just no question about that. But when you lose connection to that, you lose connection to what made your society great. You have no way forward.
I totally agree.
So, well, thank you very much. I really appreciate you coming on
Absolutely.
The Daily Signal podcast. I hope you come on again.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Daily Signal podcast is brought to you by more than 500,000 members of the Heritage Foundation. The executive producers are Rob Bluey and Kate Trinko. Producers are Virginia Allen, Doug Blair, and Samantha Rank. Sound design by Lauren Evans, Mark Guiney, and John Pop. To learn more, please visit dailysignal.com.